Thank you so much. I have the pleasure of inviting Albert Motivans. Motivans is the head of education statistics at the university at the UNESCO Institute for Statistics. He has led work in the use of comparative indicators to improve education and child welfare for over 20 years for UNESCO, UNICEF, and US Census Bureau. Here we are. We've been talking a lot about lack of data. We seem to have high expertise in here. He has published very widely in education, including the development of indicators to monitor educational inequities, and is currently working on research which explores the relationship of schools, organization resources, and opportunity to learn, and also to education opportunity in less developed countries. Welcome, Motivans.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me here. It's a real pleasure to speak to you today. But I did want to start off with a caveat of some sort. I think most of you are probably aware of the thing called Google Earth that you find on the Internet, and that when you open this package up, you see a picture of the world taken from space, and then you click your mouse and you get progressively down closer and closer and closer down to your own house or your own school. And I think it provides actually a good metaphor for what I'm going to do, because sometimes I feel like I'm not really the best person to talk about equity issues, because I'm way up high at the global level. I'm looking way from far away, and I don't see the small pictures. And, you know, many of my colleagues will say to me, but, you know, that's not really the right way to look at equity issues. Equity issues are happening at the interaction between the teacher and the classroom, the power... the power relations at the community level, at the classroom level, in the school, in the family. So I accept that, and I think that's absolutely true. But I think there's a lot to actually learn from the global picture as well. And I think what's important from looking at the global picture is you get some sense of where things are going, what the bigger picture looks like. And there's also information there which I think is quite useful for advocacy. So we've seen many of the figures cited today are from data that are collected and compiled from member states of UNESCO and compiled by us and then used in this way, so they can make very powerful arguments about overall directions in policy. So let's look at that global picture. I'd like to talk around a few research questions, and I don't want to raise expectations here because I have a short presentation. And I'm not really going to look at causality so much, but I wanted to just kind of consider the relationship between expansion and inequality. Oftentimes we think, well, there's more kids in schools, that's good. That must mean that equity, or let's use the term equality, or inequalities are being reduced. But actually, we know that the case is more complicated than that. And first of all, I'd like to look at it in terms of the more developed and the less developed world, and those countries that have, let's say, in terms of the global stock of secondary and tertiary students, you know, how that pattern is changing, and particularly in the last decade. So what are the differences in participation across countries? But then also, what is the extent of inequalities within countries? And I'll just touch upon that briefly. And I think it's kind of a growing area of work. And I think we're seeing a lot more interest we've actually been involved a lot at the primary level. So I must say that for secondary and especially tertiary, we've done much less work, simply because we've been driven by an agenda which is about universal primary education and really focusing on inequality at that level. But I think there's a great deal of work that's needed still in looking at what's happening in less developed countries. And if you look at some of the key works in the literature, they're really addressing middle-income countries, high-income countries, and very little is happening in the rest of the world. And then maybe to start out is basically linking this presentation to what we've heard already today, and that's by looking at the extent to which educational opportunities at the secondary and tertiary level are really strongly linked, of course, to what happens in the early ages, what happens before school, what happens in the early school-going ages, and how the organization of education affects entry into secondary and higher levels of education. Okay, so let me say something just a little bit about the levels of analysis and data sources. I'll be talking mostly about system-level inequalities. And the evidence base for system-level inequalities has been historically quite limited. We're talking basically about school census-based data that's collected across countries. It's very strong on inputs, but also looks at student progression, looks at student completion of school cycles, and looks at them basically through their whole school career. But it's really focused on inputs and on the distribution of inputs. So when we talk about inequality with these types of data, we're really thinking about, you know, how are resources divided across schools, and then how do children progress through the system in different ways relative to their group. Now, the group, the individual characteristics that we have are fairly limited. So we can look at gender, for example. We can look at boys and girls, young men, young women, and their ages. So that's something we can use with that data. But we can also look at political administrative units and look within a single country and look how these same kind of data can help to inform issues of resource distribution or student progression within a country. And there's some publications that are out in the front hall, and one is actually a working paper which does this, I think, for 16 countries. I think it's a useful way to do it, to look at subnational data. But more often we're interested in school and individual level inequalities. We want to look at the level of the individual, at their ethnic group affiliation, at their linguistic group affiliation, whether they're a member of a caste, whether there's other identifiers which may be create a greater vulnerability to lack of entry or participation in school. And we do have a growing amount of data to do this now. So, and I think it's really only in the last decade that we've seen this. And I'm talking from the global level now. So the national level, of course, we've always had studies which we could explore inequalities in education at the national level. But now we have standardized instruments which for the last 10 years have been using the same kind of approach to measure educational indicators. And these are like the demographic and health surveys, the LSMS from the World Bank, UNICEF's multiple indicator cluster survey. And they have these internationally harmonized education measures which allow us then to look at those who are out of school. And that's a really important issue, because when we look at the school census data, of course we're looking at children in school. And that's all we can talk about, really, are those children in school. But with the household survey data, we can also then start looking at some of these determinants or proximate determinants of school-going behavior by individuals. And then there's direct assessments of skills, and mostly this is focused at the primary level. So looking at these early grade reading, or looking at the end of cycle results. But there's also more which look at secondary and tertiary level students. And for example, PISA, which is focused on more developed countries, looks at 15-year-olds. And then there's a number of adult literacy surveys, which Statistics Canada had a huge role in implementing in the last decade. And then also newer versions of this, which then really look at then at the adult level, what the differences are in terms of literacy skills and what factors are related to those. And then we have school-based data, and that's something I'm interested in. We did a survey of primary schools in 11 countries, and it could tell us, you could tell quite a bit just in terms of the resources and the school organization, how it differs by schools, and how schools that are in disadvantaged areas and have a disadvantaged school intake really don't work within those rules. I mean, they can't conform to those rules because of the context. And I think that's a very interesting way to go ahead. And, of course, these sources and availability of data differ by level. So we know a lot more about primary education or basic education than we do about other levels, and especially tertiary education. And there's particularly a data issue there, because the data gap is that many of the higher education institutions are private or don't have any kind of requirement to report to governments in terms of students or completions or spending. And so there's huge gaps in information about what's happening in higher education. Okay, so let's go to the data, and I've got quite a bit of data, so I hope I can get through it all. I mean, just to start, let's start back where we were earlier today, and some of what I'm showing now is actually very similar in spirit to what was presented in the plenary sessions this morning. And it's really about, you know, the beginning of school and who gets in at the beginning of primary and who gets through primary and who gets through primary school with skills, I think really sets the stage for, you know, the inequalities that appear later on in secondary and tertiary. And so this figure looks at, if you look at each bar as representing all of the children in school-age children in Malawi and Namibia, a lot of them get to school in Malawi. 91% have some contact with school. So there is some contact, but then only 31% complete the cycle, or let's say reach fifth grade, sorry, not complete the cycle. So probably even fewer complete the cycle. But there's a huge gap there, and I think that's instructive on several levels, one being that there's a quality issue, that school isn't able to retain the children, that children aren't actually leaving school with the required skills. And then when we look at the required skills, we see that only 7% of that 100 children, only 7 of them actually are able to achieve a minimum mastery of reading. So that's not the best students. Those are the ones who achieved the minimum mastery of reading in Malawi. So you can see already there, and then we're looking at all the students in the, I'll just show Namibia at the same time, which are slightly different figures. But it gives you a sense of, well, what happens then in lower secondary when these children move on to lower secondary, when only 7% of them are able to have minimum mastery of reading. And I think this really sets the stage. And this is for all children, but if we looked at, let's say, disadvantaged children, let's take any kind of group, let's take a low-income group, that this would look even more dismal. Okay, so let's move on to lower secondary then. So moving from primary to lower secondary, we know that's a key transition. We know that that's a key selection device that's used by education systems often to separate children and to control the number of children that, because of capacity issues, that can actually continue on to secondary education. And sometimes when we talk about primary completion, in some countries it means passing that examination. And we see, you know, students piling up in the last grade of primary because they're being held back for different reasons from continuing. But let's look at just now at lower secondary. So lower secondary is oftentimes it's like the junior secondary, junior high school. It's like something like 7th, 8th, 9th grade. It differs by countries. But what this graph shows is by region, it's a mix of the legal framework. So the question is, this is all children of school-going age in a region, and the above the zero line, those are the children who live in countries where lower secondary is compulsory. So going back to the policy frameworks, these are the children who are in compulsory systems, and you can see that's quite common. So if we look at North America and Western Europe, all children live in countries that have lower secondaries, where lower secondary is compulsory. And you see the little 4% at the bottom, which means that, and 4% aren't in school, so there's 4% out of school. But in all of these countries, compulsory is the norm. Or sorry, lower secondary is compulsory. I think there's two important things to look at here. One is at South and West Asia, where you see approximately 77% of the children live in countries where lower secondary is compulsory, but 1 in 4 are out of school. So that means there's a policy intent, but they're not really living up to that intent. So while these children have the right, oh, 2 minutes, goodness, okay, have the right to continue, then they're not able to. And then if you look at Sub-Saharan Africa and the Arab states, there's many children living in countries where there is no compulsory education. Sorry, lower secondary is not compulsory. And so that raises that there's issues then about access. So let's move on to tertiary, and I'll try to move through this quickly. I think I just want to kind of give the impression of what's happening in tertiary. This is coming from a report which will be released in July, our next Global Education Digest. So I would definitely recommend that you have a look for that. So you can see a huge, huge increase. And we talked about the expansion in primary this morning, and that has a knock-on effect. So when primary gets more and more children coming out of primary, there's expectations for going on to secondary. And when secondary grows big, expectations for going on to tertiary. But you see some of this is already happening now. You can see on the far right, especially since 99, 2000, there's been really massive growth in tertiary enrollments. And where is it happening? It's not happening in more developed countries, or at least in terms of absolute numbers. So if we look at the share of where these students come from, we see this middle bar, sorry, the middle group there, which ends up in 59% in 2007, that 60% of the tertiary students in the world today are coming from developing countries, less developed countries, sorry, rather than more developed countries. And the share of more developed countries has dropped drastically over this period. So that's a good story, right? If we look at then the distribution of tertiary students, then that means that the less developed countries are doing great. That's a good story in absolute terms. But then when we look at it in terms of relative terms, so we look at a gross enrollment ratio by region, then we see, of course, there's still a great deal of inequality. And if we look at the coverage of populations in different regions, that 71% in North America and Western Europe are enrolled in higher education, and that there's increases in there as well. But if you look at it's kind of the weight of numbers, and that in East Asia and the Pacific, there's been what looks like still low coverage is also a huge number of tertiary students. I just wanted to touch upon gender disparities in tertiary education, and I think that was very interesting, the previous presentation which dealt with this. You can see, again, very large changes. Now, this is looking at a kind of a gender parity index. So you can see, for example, North America and Western Europe is 1.25 times higher for females. So there's 1.25 times higher women in higher education than there are men. And you can see how that's changed over time. You can see when a specific region has made that transition between favoring, let's say, in a way, young men and favoring young women. But you can also see the huge gap at the bottom, which is still quite still a far away from gender parity. And I think it's really important to note, as it was noted in the last presentation, that it's not just about numbers of enrollments, that there's issues about the types of schools that women go to versus men. If you look at the Gulf states, women look like they're favored, but in fact, most of the young men are going abroad for their education, and the women stay in local institutions. And if you look at it by field of study, there's enormous differences again. And I think you especially see these in science and in engineering, where women are markedly underrepresented. Okay, so I've only got two slides to go. I hope I can count on the sympathy of my timer. I'll go through this one quickly, but there maybe is a lot more to look at here. Basically, what we're looking at is 2007 data from the DHS, and we're looking at two population groups. The one on the right are the older generation, 45 to 64. They went to school in the 70s and the 80s. On the left, we see the younger generation. So they went to school in the 90s and in the 2000s. And this is the educational attainment. So how many have attained tertiary education? But there's all different levels there, but let's just focus on tertiary, which is at the top. So first of all, let's look at the old generation. And we see in the old generation, first of all, there's huge wealth effects, right? So among the poor, only 17% had any education at all, and 83% had no schooling whatsoever. But then you look at the richer one, and this is divided up, 40%, 40%, 20%. So 20% of the richest, 40% of the poorest. That even there, half the population hadn't any schooling. So it was quite low levels of schooling in Pakistan at that time. Now we see, if we look at the younger generation, that's shifted a bit. So overall education levels are improving. Tertiary education has widened. But again, we see this huge effect that those better off are those who have access to higher education. So you see that 24% of those rich is not the right word, but let's say in the top 20% of family assets or wealth, attained higher education compared to only 2% of the poorest. And again, there's many, many stories here. This is from a report that we did with UNICEF. And what we did is we took this household survey data and we mapped the educational progression of the population by age. So for India, unfortunately, we only have up to age 14. But for Indonesia, Nigeria, and Mali, you can follow them all the way through tertiary ages. On the left side of the bar, you find the most wealthy, the 20% highest in income. On the right, the poorest 20%. And it's really quite dramatic. Let's not even talk about higher education yet. Let's simply talk about primary education, where the modal, the highest participation in Mali for the poorest 20% starts at age 12. So that's when the highest number of students are in primary school. And then you see, of course, it drops off markedly as they grow older. And in fact, we see almost no higher education at all among the poorest 20% of the population. We have more on this that we can show, but I want to end here. Thank you for letting me go on a little bit. I think that the one of the key messages for me is really, I mean, what we've seen from the key work in more developed countries, from the work of Chavez and Blasfeld, is that there's a real persistence in inequality, and that we see it kind of move up the ladder, that when primary becomes accessible to all or good quality, let's say good quality primary becomes accessible to all, this ladder moves up. And I don't know if many of you students also feel this now, where a graduate degree is now considered a minimum qualification for a university student in Canada now. So we see this kind of pattern developing, and there's still a great deal of work that has to be done in looking at these patterns in less developed countries. Thank you.